Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard McGregor, a journalist, writer, and author who was the chief political correspondent, Japan correspondent, and China correspondent for The Australian, as well as the China bureau chief of the Financial Times. He also worked for the International Herald Tribune, the BBC, and the Far East Economic Review. And he's the author of the new book, just out, The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard McGregor.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And the wife of the disgraced Communist Party leader, Bo Xilai, she got a suspended death sentence for her role in the murder of the British businessman. Now, that strikes me as being not entirely surprising. Do the Chinese Communist Party want to send that signal to the people that the party is above the law? I mean, on the one hand, she was punished, but if she was anybody but the wife of an important party member, she'd be dead by now, right? She'd be before a firing squad.
Perhaps she would be. She certainly would have been 10 years ago. But, you know, it's kind of an artful decision. It sounds like a tough decision, a suspended death sentence. But in reality, it's basically they're trying to look tough while they're not being so. I mean, it's very important to remember that throughout this trial of the wife, as you say, of Bo Xilai, one of China's most powerful politicians, the courts in China and the judges in this case made sure that Bo's name was never mentioned at all. It was all about his wife and her misdeeds. It was kind of a show trial without the show. In other words, they put it on for a day, convicted her, and now they've given her what sounds like a tough sentence. But I don't think the message has worked in the way that they would have liked it to.
And in what sense do you mean that?
Well, I think that the China social media is very powerful in China, and I think the trial has been criticized from both the left and the right, if you like, if we can define them as that. Certainly people in the sort of more pro-Western or pro-liberal or pro-democratic camp have basically seen the trial as a bit of a farce, just a sort of process rather than an attempt to elucidate and display the facts of the case. And I think that on the left, the more Maoist types, the more people who adhere to the old communist line, also think it was a farce because they don't think it looked at the problems of the party, the problems of corruption, and the sorts of things the rich and powerful people get away with. And I think in trying to walk a middle line, the authorities didn't succeed too well.
So in their relationship with the public in terms of their legitimacy, do they want the Chinese people to fear them or love them or both?
Well, I think it's both. I think that's a good question. I think I've had many Chinese officials when I lived in China saying it was very important that the people feared the government because that was just sort of like keeping power in reserve. You know, you could keep your powder dry while they did what was expected of them. But I think the Communist Party is a much more modern and sophisticated operation than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago. They much prefer to run, or to govern by co-option rather than coercion. If somebody challenges the party politically and persists in doing that, then they have no compunction in locking them up and putting them away in a very harsh fashion. But I think they realize that that's not a formula success for success in the long term, and they much prefer to bring people on board and make them supporters. So, they would like to be both feared and loved. If they could do both in equal measures, I think they'd be doing very well.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard McGregor, are you still the China Bureau Chief or not?
I'm now the Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, but I was in China for 10 years. Okay. For the Financial Times.
again, I'm speaking with Richard McGregor, who was the China bureau chief for the Financial Times for the last 10 years and now Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times. He's the author of a new book just out, The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Party Rulers. Now, I recall Gorbachev showed up in China at the time of the Tiananmen, the prelude to the Tiananmen before the crackdown, and it sort of brought into focus the difference between the two approaches of the communist parties of the Soviet Union, which is now extinct, and China, in as much as the Soviets tried perestroika, economic reform, but they thought glasnost, the ability to speak out and speak openly, was needed to stimulate perestroika. And in effect, that unraveled the whole system because the emperor had no clothes. Now, the Chinese have been taken the reverse, the you know, in terms of the cart before the horse. They've taken the reverse approach, which is allowed perestroika, but not glasnost. So, do you think that this system can last forever in terms of perestroika without a little bit of glasnost?
No. I should first say that Gorbachev had many admirers in the West, but very few in the Communist Party in China, and they've spent years and years and years studying what went wrong. And why the Communist Party in the Soviet Union unraveled, because the Chinese Communist Party is modeled in its form and structure on the old Soviet system. And certainly they think that he put far too much emphasis on political reform without economic reform and growth. And so far, if you're looking at the results, the Chinese Chinese system has performed and lasted much more than the Soviet system. But, you know, there'll come a point when, I mean, the biggest, most important thing underlining the credibility of the Chinese Communist Party is economic growth. They've had almost 10% for 30 years. It's a remarkable achievement. But that won't go on forever. All the winners these days who've enjoyed that 10% growth won't be so easily bought off in 5-10 years' time. The economy will mature and slow down. That'll happen in, you know, 5 to 10 years. It's inevitable. And that's, I think, when things will get very difficult for the Communist Party, when people, you know, won't have the easy growth. They'll be looking for other things, for their rights and the like. When it will happen, when there'll be a crisis in China, it's impossible to say. But I think certainly in the future there'll be a big one.
So, in terms of corruption, which of course was a big issue in the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and to some extent has come back now with KGB incorporated under Putin, where he essentially regulates the billionaires, and presumably was getting, when he, if and when he retires, he's probably going to be one of the richest men on the planet. Conversely, in China, they do have the party, which we've seen in the Bo Xilai case, have obviously have connections to big state enterprises. But how does that operate, and how much is corruption a factor here? If you've got such secrecy, no transparency, and these vast wealthy state enterprises that the party oversees.
Yeah, let me answer that in a couple of ways. I mean, first of all, I think the sorts of corruption you saw in the former Soviet Union in the early 1990s, when the oligarchs grabbed hold of, as individuals, of a huge number of resources, that hasn't happened in China. The big state firms like PetroChina, Sinopec, they're amongst the biggest 20 companies in the world. If that were Russia, they'd be owned by a single person, and that's not the case. So in that respect, you know, China has managed the corporatization of, you know, Communist Party assets much better than the Russians ever did. But having said that, you know, corruption is a fact of life in China. It's deep. It's entrenched. In some respects, to put it most charitably, it's transactional. In other words, it's a cut on every deal, and in that respect, can grease the wheels a little bit. But I think it's gone beyond that now, and there's been some remarkable stories come out in the last year through, you know, dogged reporting by Western outlets of the enormous fortunes held by the families of top communist leaders, which have been hugely embarrassing for the party and the government in Beijing. I mean, just quickly, two examples. When Bo Xilai fell, I think Bloomberg were able to uncover by looking at the family holdings in various listed companies in Hong Kong. Within 2 weeks, they'd found about $130, $150 million worth. The same applied in the case of the family of Xi Jinping, who's going to take over China at the end of this year. His family, we don't know what his involvement is worth hundreds of millions of dollars as well. And this all feeds back into China these days. So, you know, as long as I said before, the economy is trundling along at 7 to 10% a year, well, that's okay. But once things slow down, you know, that kind of corruption is going to be very, very destabilizing, I think.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard McGregor, who for the last 10 years has been the bureau chief of the Financial Times in China, and he's the author of the new book just out, The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers. I understand, Richard, that the princelings, the young children of the Communist Party elite, not so much young, but because the you know the leadership has been quite elderly for some time, but they have apparently been meeting informally to discuss more liberalization of the economy, etc. And meanwhile, of course, they're presumably the beneficiaries of all of this money that's you just mentioned. What is the generational change there between the apparatchiks in charge now and the princelings apparently having these informal meetings about economic reform?
Well, it depends in some ways how you define princeling. As you say, they're not all young. Bo Xilai, in theory, was a princeling. He's in his 60s. Xi Jinping, who I mentioned before, who will take over in coming months, is also a, you know, quote-unquote princeling, is the son of a former top Chinese leader. In some ways, the term's thrown around loosely. You know, it's just anybody with connections to somebody in a powerful position becomes a princeling. I mean, my view about China is that it's a funny mixture of meritocracy and aristocracy. If you look at the top two leaders in the country now, they came from nothing at all. They're not the sons of privilege in any fashion. Xi Jinping, of course, is a princeling, but he's had to prove himself in the system over a long period of time. So he's not, you know, just a sort of the idiot son of somebody rich who's been handed the job on a platter. The types of meetings you're talking about, I think, are from younger princelings, younger people with good connections. And because they have good connections, they have some sort of greater space or greater liberty to, you know, meet, to discuss reform and the like, which if it were done by other people organizing an alternative political party, would cause big problems. So it's interesting that they're discussing the need for reform, and if they see the need for reform, then I think it's a pretty clear sign that it's necessary.
Well, there's a very good film out, Richard, about Ai Weiwei, the Chinese artist, and you really get a feeling for the bravery of this very lonely man. There's a scene in it where his mother says, you know, and she and her husband, who was a famous Chinese poet, had suffered under the various Maoist purges. And the mother's telling Ai Weiwei, you know, just be an artist, you know, give this up. This is too much. You know, you're taking on the entire, you know, you're taking the whole struggle on your own shoulders. What's your sense of, because in this film you got the distinct impression that a lot of Chinese people admired Ai Weiwei, but you also saw the kind of thuggery of the police and how much they control the country, particularly in the rural areas.
Yes, I mean, I haven't seen the film. I've read about it, but I've certainly met Ai Weiwei often over the years, and he's a remarkable character and very brave. And, of course, if you look at it, you sometimes think he has to be crazy because he has taunted the government, and that's only going to bring trouble upon himself. So he has extraordinary, character and fortitude to do that, because really, once the authorities decide, you know, once you look into the abyss in China, it's very deep and very dark. And the authorities will pursue him until he sort of lays down, as it were. I mean, his father, as you say, was one of the country's most famous poets, and in the Cultural Revolution was sent to live in far western China in Xinjiang and made to clean toilets. And I think Ai Weiwei remembers watching his father do that and do it with great, you know, dedication. You know, his father said, well, if I'm going to, you know, clean the toilets, I'm going to have the cleanest toilets possible. And I think he carries that with him to this day. You know, he's a great artist. He's a great activist. You know, some people criticize him for pandering to Western sensibilities and the like. But I think he's also a very, very Chinese character as well.
But he took on some of these corruption cases, particularly after the earthquake and these cheaply built schools, which indicated a lot of corruption at the official level. And, you know, the party covered all that up, paid off people. And, of course, there was the other disturbing case, the Sanlu case, in which thousands of babies were poisoned by contaminated milk powder. How much... do these, the combined nature of these, weigh on the Chinese people? Because my understanding is that you have a sort of somewhat schizophrenic government there, in as much as there have been attempts over the years to create civil society, create a legal system, to create a government bureaucracy, but then you've got this extra layer of the party that controlling everything with what, 73 million people or members?
Yeah, even more now. Yeah, look, it's interesting. Let me go back to Ai Weiwei's mother first, for example. I mean, Ai Weiwei was pursuing, you know, he wanted the acknowledgement of all the young kids who'd been killed in these schools and the Sichuan earthquake. And his mother used to urge him to give up the chase. And he said, well, gosh, you know, if I died like that, wouldn't you like to know about it? And the Sanlu case, and I have a chapter in my book about the Sanlu case, which is about the poison baby formula milk. I think the impact of all these things are accumulative and are sort of sowing the gradual sort of deep disillusionment with the system in China. But, you know, you don't want to take that analysis too far, because otherwise, you know, you end up thinking the whole place is going to collapse. I don't think that's going to happen because, the party, the government, there's enormous corruption, there's all sorts of issues and the like, but they're also... very responsive. If there's a problem, for the most part, they will try and fix it. They won't tolerate democracy or anything like that. But they, you know, there is pressure on officials at a local level to, you know, run a good government. They're judged on their performances. So the system has been modernized. They've got a very solid and modern bureaucracy. One of the characters in my book said, you know, the system is developing, but the system is decaying at the same time. It is schizophrenic, as you said, and we don't quite know which one is going to come out on top.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Richard McGregor.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard McGregor, who's a journalist, a writer, and author. He was the chief political correspondent, Japan correspondent, and China correspondent for The Australian, as well as, for the last 10 years, the China bureau chief for the Financial Times. He also worked for the International Herald Tribune, the BBC, and the Far East Economic Review, and he's the author of the new book just out, The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.